3 U.S. Marines are killed and 20 others injured in a helicopter crash during military exercises in northern Australia. A white gunman kills 3 black people before shooting himself in the latest racially motivated gun violence incident in the U.S. Also coming up, several Palestinians are injured as Israeli forces storm the occupied West Bank city of Tal Karam, prompting violent clashes with resistance fighters. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. A military helicopter crash in northern Australia has left 3 U.S. Marines dead and 20 others wounded. 5 Marines are in critical condition. The deadly incident happened after an Osprey military aircraft crashed during a military exercise in the northern island of Melville. Efforts are underway to transport all of the injured soldiers to the hospital. According to the Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, no Australian personnel were involved in the crash. The helicopter was taking part in joint military drills involving thousands of soldiers from several countries. In the U.S., 3 people have been killed at a store in Jacksonville, Florida, by a white gunman in what police say was a racist rampage targeting black people.
This afternoon, a little after 1 p.m., an individual we have not yet officially identified entered a Dollar Tree in a Newtown area of Jacksonville, outfitted with a tactical vest, armed with an AR-style rifle and a handgun. Then the shooter killed 3 people before turning the gun on himself, taking his own life. Other than the 3 individuals killed and the shooter himself, there are no additional people who suffered gunshot wounds. We are not identifying the deceased victims at this time, but I can tell you that there are 2 male victims and 1 female victim. All of the deceased victims are black. This shooting was racially motivated, and he hated black people. He wanted to kill niggers. That's the one and only time I'll use that word.
Police said the shooter was armed with a high-powered rifle that was marked by swastikas. Officials said the suspect had left messages that detailed his hatred for black people. The FBI said federal officials had opened a civil rights investigation and would pursue the incident as a hate crime. At least 5 Palestinians have been injured in another Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank. The regime forces stormed the northern city of Tal Karam, prompting violent clashes with resistance fighters. Tensions have been running high across the occupied West Bank in recent months as Israeli troops launched near-daily raids there. Palestinians have increasingly also been fighting back and launching retaliatory operations. On Saturday, the regime forces stormed a village near the city of Jenin and arrested several Palestinians. However, they were forced to retreat after coming under fire from resistance fighters. Around 230 Palestinians have been killed at the hands of Israeli forces this year, and many others have been arrested. A correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, earlier joined us for more details about the Israeli raid.
Early on Sunday, Israeli military raided Tal Karam city and remained there for over 4 hours, according to the residents of Tal Karam. They said that Israeli troops conducted an arrest raid. A number of Palestinians had been wounded, but the exact number is still unknown. Exchange of fire erupted between Israeli forces and the Palestinian fighters. Members of resistance groups from the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade and Saraya Al-Quds, the armed wing of the Jihad movement, according to those resistance groups who issued statements this morning, saying that their fighters exchange of fire and clashed with the Israeli forces for several hours in Tal Karam. Their fighters also hurled explosive devices at the Israeli military vehicles that forced the Israeli troops to end their military raid, and it was not a widespread military raid. However, during this operation, at least 5 Palestinians had been wounded. One of them has been shot in the his hand, and he was in a serious condition, according to Palestinian paramedics.
Protests over the judicial overhaul plan proposed by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's far-right cabinet continues for the 34th consecutive week. Protesters are saying the 200-plus different proposals are turning Israel into a dictatorship. They say that the regime is trying to control the Supreme Court and thus all three systems in Israel. The opposition believes the cabinet is aiming to weaken the judiciary and to prevent it from being able to maintain checks and balances on the cabinet. The opposition has also said Netanyahu, who is currently on trial on charges of several counts of corruption, tries to use this scheme to quash possible judgments against them. Israel is facing public unrest, labor strikes, and mutiny by some members of the military. Lebanon says it has busted members of an Israeli spy cell at Beirut's Rafik Hariri International Airport. According to Lebanon's chief of public security, two people were arrested while attempting to leave Lebanon and were handed over to Lebanon's judiciary. The official said the cell was tasked with missions inside the country and that they will reveal more details on the group's activities in the future. The Israeli regime has a vast espionage apparatus and has conducted numerous spy operations against Palestinians and regional countries. Lebanese security services have arrested dozens over the years on suspicion of collaborating with Israel, with some receiving jail terms of up to 25 years. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, earlier joined us with more details on the arrest of the Israeli spies.
This time it wasn't done through Lebanese collaborators, actually. It was done through perhaps Israelis themselves who were using Russian passports. And that is one of the possibilities that we know. Of course, we were told by head of the Internal Security that he will give us more details later. But what we do know right now is that this is a cell comprised of two individuals. And they will be, of course, gathering more information through the interrogations. And of course, that will probably lead to other individuals who are implicated in this cell or other cells as well. But as you know, we have various cells that are working within Lebanon. Not every single cell is working with the other, but usually the Israelis are working with all of these cells. Now, we do have, of course, very high incidence of Israeli espionage activity, especially after the 2019 economic crisis. We noticed how that really peaked. We have over 185 individuals who were arrested since 2019 until 2022. A lot of them are even employees in the telecommunications sector. Perhaps they were trying to get more information through telecoms from members of Hezbollah, getting more information on the activity of the resistance in Lebanon.
Muslims living in The Hague in the Netherlands have staged a protest condemning the desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden and Denmark. Demonstrators gathered on the main street of The Hague and also outside of the Swedish embassy there to vent their anger at the sacrilegious move. They were holding copies of the Quran in their hands and reciting verses from the Muslims' holy book denouncing the profane act. Recent desecrations of the Holy Quran in some European countries have drawn the ire of the Muslim community worldwide. UK police hit by another data disaster. London's Metropolitan Police Force is on high alert after what has been described as a staggering security breach involving the IT system of one of its suppliers. A spokesperson for the Metropolitan Police say that any potential leak will cause colleagues incredible concern and anger. Scotland Yard says it cannot say when the breach occurred or how many personnel might be affected. The company in question had access to the names, ranks, photos, vetting levels, and pay numbers for officers and staff. The breach comes just weeks after the Police Service of Northern Ireland admitted it had mistakenly published personal information about all of its 10,000 staff. Norfolk and Suffolk Police, which covers the east of England, also later announced it had mistakenly released information about more than 1,200 people. British MP and former Minister Nadine Dorries has resigned from the Commons, accusing the Premier Rishi Sunak of endangering her safety by whipping up a public frenzy against her. Dorries lashed out at Sunak, saying that he had abandoned conservative principles. She also said the country is being run by a zombie parliament. Dorries was a key ally of the former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. In June, she announced her plan to quit with immediate effect after she was denied a seat in the House of Lords. Dorries accused Sunak's government of removing her name from the list and said she wanted to know why she was refused a seat. Researcher and political analyst Christopher Hilali joined us earlier for comments. Here's his explanation about the resignation of the Conservative British MP and its political ramifications.
It's very deep and troubling what's going on in the United Kingdom at this point. We see with the MP that just resigned, Nadine, that there's a lot of upheaval in the Conservative Party. Of course, she's hurled a lot of vitriol and accusations at Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. Of course, she's from the wing of the Conservative Party, very loyal to former Prime Minister Boris Johnson. She was, of course, a Secretary of Culture under him. And so right now she's saying that Rishi Sunak is destroying the Conservative Party. He's created a zombie parliament. Nothing's getting done. Business is leaving London for the United States. And so she's deeply concerned about the situation. And part of this is a new book she has coming out now that she's resigned about the plot to destroy Boris Johnson and obviously to destroy the Conservative Party and the faction that she belongs to. So there's a lot of turmoil going on in the Conservative Party, no doubt. And this, of course, is a boon to the Labour Party, to the Liberal Democrats, to the Greens, and to others who are going to take, sense blood in the water, and they're going to try to take those seats away from Conservatives who have by-elections coming up.
Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa has won a second term in office. Official results announced by the country's Electoral Commission indicate that he won 52.6% of the ballots against 44% for the main challenger, Nelson Chamisa. However, the opposition has rejected the results, making accusations of vote rigging and voter suppression. The opposition hoped to emerge victorious due to the wave of discontent over the poor economic situation in the country. Mnangagwa's ruling ZANU-PF party was also declared the winner in the parliamentary vote, a race. Voter turnout was around 70%. Anti-French sentiment is growing in Niger after Paris defiantly insisted the military government in Niamey cannot expel its ambassador. Now military leaders have called on the people to turn up and to show their support for the government. They say the French envoy must leave the country.
The fight will not stop until the day there is no longer any French soldiers in Niger. We told them to leave our country to us, to leave, to let our country be. But it's you who will chase them away. To chase them away, don't go to the embassy. If the mobilization continues, they'll leave.
The French have been asked to leave, but they refused. We are going to defeat those plotting against our country. We are going to defeat them and stomp them out.
Victory to the people. It is the people of Niger who will decide what will become of this country. United, we stand.
Tens of thousands of people rallied in a stadium in the capital, wearing and waving the country's flag. They expressed their full support for the country's military government that came to power following last month's coup. They also urged Western countries, especially France, to respect their choice of government. The military leaders in Niamey have accused Paris of seeking to use force in order to reinstate the ousted president. On Friday, they gave France's ambassador 48 hours to leave the country. A young Palestinian footballer has become a star after winning the player of the tournament during the Norway Cup, which is the biggest international youth football tournament in the world. Ola Lassi has more from Gaza.
Al-Bayouk family, who lives in one of the most marginalized areas in southern Gaza Strip, Qizan Rishwan, is the main supporter of the talented son Mohammed as he's pursuing his dream. The 13-year-old boy was elected to participate in the football contest in Tunisia, but his permit to leave the besieged Gaza Strip was denied by the Israeli authorities. But when he managed to leave the region and participated in the tournament, Mohammed did his best for his country.
My son, along with his teammates from the besieged Gaza Strip, got the chance to compete in the Norway Cup finals against four countries with 43 teams. I knew that my son is talented, but I just was able to support him with what was available due to the economic situation in the besieged Gaza Strip. It wasn't easy for me as a father of four to provide food and equipment needed to improve his physical condition and skills. Sometimes I couldn't buy him football shoes due to high prices, so he had to play with low-quality second-hand ones or to borrow from our friends and neighbors.
It was Friday noon and the whole family gathered to watch the match. I was praying for him. It was a tough match, especially in the extra time, and it was my son who scored the golden goal that qualified them for the finals. I was happy for him that he managed to leave Gaza to participate in the Norway Cup, but at the same time, I was concerned for his safety. But thankfully, they came back with the cup and they raised the Palestinian flag in the world.
The passion for playing football has grown fast, and 2 years ago he had the chance to sharpen his skills when he joined the Youth Stars Center, where he used to train with low-quality equipment.
I love football so much. Despite the cancelling of our trip to Tunisia by the Israeli occupation, I made it up to Norway and won the cup, where I scored 5 goals. I wish we had big stadiums like those I played there. Here, I play at the pitches with poor quality. I wish I could join Real Madrid club one day and play like Luka Modric. I wish I could visit Portugal, Spain, France and Denmark. I've shown the whole world that even if we suffer from the Israeli occupation in the besieged Gaza Strip and don't have the chance like other children around the world and don't enjoy our full rights, despite all that, we're resilient and we try our best.
Israel always interferes in the Palestinian sports affairs. It denies entry of equipment needed for different sports. Palestinian athletes face arrest and travel bans when they have to participate in a tournament. Israeli suffocating blockade is destroying sports facilities in the Gaza Strip. The Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have demonstrated a strong determination to stand up against occupation, blockade, and poverty. The young Palestinians have understood that this is their only hope to gain international support.
Despite the overwhelming odds that Palestinians endure in the Gaza Strip, a glimpse of hope shines through the most impoverished areas in defiance, telling the whole world that there is on this land whatever makes life worth living. Ula Al-Asi, Gaza.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Tell a little about yourself.
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of journalism.
Listeners special.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warmest greetings to you all. Welcome to another edition of Listeners Special on this warm, beautiful Sunday, August 27th, 2023. I'm Atef Erfani, hosting this program today. Listeners, especially, is a Sunday program where your views are presented through your emails, your letters, and your messages. So please contact us and tell us what you think about our programs. Tell us which program or programs you like the most. And if you have any message for our listeners around the world, you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program. Remember, Listeners Especial is your program. It's your views that are important. Please keep us company until the end of the program. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, and here we've received reception reports from around the world from Najmuddin from Bangladesh. Najmuddin is one of our old and regular listeners, and from Sohal Gupta from India, and G. Hojibens from Belgium has sent us reception reports. So, Najmuddin, G, and Sohal, thank you for the reception reports. We want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. And let's see who has sent us a piece of writing, email, or a letter from Russia. We've received an email from Alexei Kolakov. As you know, Alexei Kolakov is one of our old and regular listeners. From India, we've received an email from Bashir Ahmad. Michael Hudak from the Czech Republic has sent us a piece of email. From Finland, we have an email from David Mobby, one of our regular listeners. And the last but not the least in this edition of Listeners Special is an email from Je Hojibens from Belgium. Stay with us, please. We will be back with you with these great emails from around the world. Welcome back. So let's see what Alexei Kolakov from Russia, one of our old and regular listeners, says. He says, "Dear staff, I want to ask you a question. Can I listen to other services of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran and send you via email a reception report? Please write your answer to this email. Thank you." First of all, salam and greetings to you, Alexei Kolakov from Russia, and thank you very much for this email. So, you asked whether you could be able to listen to other services of IRIB radio stations in other languages and send us via email a reception report. And I have to say that you can keep in touch with other radio stations of IRIB via their own emails. They surely have their own email address, which are allocated only for their own listeners. Anyway, thank you for your kind attention, Alexei Kolakov from Russia. We wish you all the best, and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. And my colleagues will soon send you an EQSL as confirmation to this email. Well, from India, Bashir Ahmad has sent us a piece of email. Bashir Ahmad says, "Warm greetings. My name is Bashir, and I always like to write to you and talk about global affairs. I like your analysis programs and new sections. I wish you and all listeners a world full of prosperity." And salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran. Appreciations to you, Bashir, for this email. It's good to hear that you like the analysis program and new section. And you're interested in global affairs, of course. We also wish you a world full of peace, prosperity, and justice. We also wish you all the best, and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. An EQSL card will be sent to you on behalf of IRIB English Radio. After a short break, I will be back with you. From the Czech Republic, we've received an email from Michael Hudak. Michael says, "Dear Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, I'm sending you the report of receipt of your station in the Czech Republic. I hope my reports is okay with your playlist and will send me your QSL or an electronic QSL. Thank you very much. Best regards. Salam and warm greetings from Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran, to you, Michael Hudak from the Czech Republic. Thank you for your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. And it's good to hear that the signals of IRIB English Radio is heard in your region and in your country, the Czech Republic. An EQSL card will soon be sent to you on our behalf. Michael Hudak from the Czech Republic. We wish you all the best. And we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon and hear your views about our radio broadcast. And here from Finland, David Moby, one of our regular listeners, has sent us a piece of email. David says, "Dear friends at IRIB English Radio, I am a DX listener since a teenager and still going strong at the age of 72. It's been some time since I last sent you a reception report from my home here in Turku in southwest Finland. I do hope that you are all keeping well. Your station is really something special as you give another way of looking at what's going on in this world of ours. Yesterday, Friday, I tuned in to your radio. Your signal was strong and your modulation level varied during the program but was on average better than usual compared to the past few months. From previous correspondence, you may recall that I like to listen to your news analysis broadcast. Today was no exception. It's great to get the Iranian perspective. I wonder if you could supply me with a full program schedule of your daily broadcast. I know I would also enjoy a lot of Iranian music and features about your history. I really hope you can send me your EQSL. May I thank you kindly in advance and look forward to hearing from you soon? Salam and warm greetings to you on this warm, sunny Sunday of summer, David Moby from Finland. So, you're 72 and you're still going strong, being a DX listener since you were a teenager, and it's great. And you're from Turku in southwest of Finland. And it's good to hear that the signals of IRIB English Radio are well heard in your region in Turku. As you said, the proof is that the signals of IRIB English Radio was strong and the modulation level varied during the program but was on average better than usual compared to the past few weeks and months, of course, you said. David Moby from Finland, thank you for your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio, and thank you for this detailed and elaborate email you sent to IRIB English Radio. Please accept our appreciations to you for letting us know your views about the quality of the signals and the programs. As you said, you like the analysis broadcast, the analysis programs, the news analysis. So you listen to it regularly and you like the Iranian perspective, which is fair, unbiased, and of course, accurate. You can find the program, the full program schedule on our website, which is parstoday.ir/en. And there also you can find the archive of our programs, the programs about Iranian music, Iranian market, Iranian tourist attraction sites, many other programs. There we have the online programs and archive of the programs. So please accept our electronic QSL as confirmation to this email. We wish you all the best and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. After a short break, I will be back with you, dear listeners. Welcome back. Let's see what Jay Hojibens from Belgium says. Dear IRIB, I have much pleasure in informing you that I heard your station and I hope you will be interested in my reception report. My receiving location is Beffe, situated in the Ardennes, about 100 kilometers southeast of the town Brussels and 20 kilometers on the border of Luxembourg. Will you please check this reception report of your station, and if it is correct, please verify my reception report by your QSL verification. Many thanks for your kind attention. Salam and warm greetings from Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran, to you, Jay Hojibens from Belgium. We are so glad that we hear that the signals of IRIB English Radio are received in your region, in Beffe. As you said, it is situated in the Ardennes, about 100 kilometers southeast of Brussels and 20 kilometers on the border of Luxembourg. Please accept our EQSL as confirmation to this email. Write to us soon and tell us your views about our broadcast. And many thanks for your kind attention. And dear listeners of Listeners Special, before saying goodbye to you and before ending the program, I do send my warm gratitudes and appreciations to those of you who kindly sent us reception reports as well as emails and letters from around the world, including Najmuddin from Bangladesh, Jay Hojibens from Belgium, Sohal Gupta from India, Alexei Kulakov from Russia, Bashir Ahmad from India, Michael Hudak from the Czech Republic, and David Mabi from Finland. Please keep in touch with us at IRIB English Radio and the program Listeners Special. We wish you all the best. God bless you and goodbye.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We will be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send us emails to englishradio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at parstoday.ir/en. Our phone number is 0098-21-2201-3720. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The historic development and a strategic success for the foreign policy of the Islamic Republic. That is how Iran's permanent membership in the group of global emerging economies has been described. Other countries that have helped kickstart the expansion are Saudi Arabia, UAE, Egypt, Argentina, and Ethiopia. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why these countries were picked and look at other key developments from this summit, such as de-dollarization. First, let me introduce our guests. Richard Methurst, journalist and commentator, joins us from Vienna. Also joining us is Lawrence Freeman, Africa Affairs expert, who joins us from Baltimore. Welcome to you both. Richard Metters, let me first start with you. So this is a big deal, I think. Your opinion matters here. And it was quite surprising when they made the announcement, because it was said that BRICS was going to pick countries from different parts of the world with different offerings that it had for example, natural resources such as energy. I mean, that was how it was described. But we can see that you have Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Iran that were picked, which obviously are within one region. But tell us what your thoughts are specifically, and at least relative to what we see as being very important, is Iran's admission to this bloc.
Hi, well, thanks for having me on. And this is really an incredible development. And I think leading up to this summit, more people were anticipating the announcement of a gold-backed currency, because the Russian embassy in Kenya had mentioned such a project being worked on. And I've no doubt that they are cooking up something in that regard, but perhaps maybe next year we'll hear about it. It was not guaranteed that we would get a BRICS currency, nor that any countries would accede to BRICS, and yet, nevertheless, here we are. And they've picked countries that strengthen their presence in each continent. And so now, instead of just having Brazil, which is already, again, a beast of an economy in Latin America, now you also have Argentina. And Brazil and Argentina have spoken themselves about using a different trade currency between themselves, other than the dollar, specifically to get off the dollar. Now in Africa, you not only have South Africa within BRICS, but also Egypt, which is the most populous Arab country, and also Ethiopia. And so now you have BRICS with access to the Red Sea on both fronts there. And then when it comes to the Middle East or West Asia, I mean, having Iran was a natural, logical choice. Who else? And it's also good that they've taken Saudi Arabia with Iran, because just recently we saw that there was a peace deal mediated by the Chinese between the two. So now, in the capacity of BRICS, you will have Iran and Saudi Arabia working together, which of course encourages diplomacy and bilateral and multilateral relations. And so the natural resources aspect, which you mentioned, is logical too, because Saudi Arabia and Iran are among the world's top oil producers. Now, if you look at the list of top 10 oil producers in the world, six of those 10 countries are in BRICS. So that speaks for itself. The G7 is dead and irrelevant, and all eyes are on BRICS now. And so having the UAE and Saudi Arabia and Iran accede to BRICS is a very, very good thing. And I think one note about Putin, because the Western press, they had a field day pointing out that he was attending via a screen and not in person, and that this made him look small or something like that. I think this is ridiculous, because when Iran and the other five countries accede to BRICS in January 2024, the chairmanship, the presidency of BRICS will be given to Russia, and the next summit, the first time that you see Iran and the other five countries on stage as full BRICS members is going to be in Russia, right next to Putin.
And add to that the New Development Bank, Lawrence Freeman, whose president is Dilma Rousseff, the former Brazilian president. And, of course, we have the new members, as our guests there mentioned, who will be admitted and operational starting the new year. Before, you used to get, it's not too long ago, descriptions about BRICS being not a very well united, nor much to offer in terms of any development that may take place, or in so many words. But how can the West, in particular, looking at European countries and the U.S., deny the fact that BRICS does have something to say? Our guests there mentioned 6 out of the 10 countries are the top world oil producers. And, of course, 25% of the world's GDP, projected to be 33%, and, 40% of the world population. Along with that, I think you're going to get political leverage coming out of this grouping, right?
This action that was announced today makes very clear something I've known for a while and I anticipated, is the world has changed with now 11 nations among the BRIC nations This is a physical change in the universe, and the politics of the West is going to have to catch up to that. Going into the BRICS summit, there were thousands, tens of thousands of words from the Western media, from pundits, from ambassadors, from governments of the West. Oh, this summit is much ado about nothing. It's a nothing burger. Nothing will happen. I was criticizing them constantly. And yet, it's a spectacular, game-changing development. And right now, the West wanted to believe that they, in their rules-based international order, maintain unipolar hegemony in the world. That's over. As of today, that's over. And now there is new potential because the BRICS is a different model. And it's a model based on development. You mentioned the former president of Brazil. She oversees the National Development Bank, which is going to increase its funding and loans, and it's going to have 30% or more of its loans are going to be in regional currencies. I did not expect that there would be a new currency announced, but I did expect that more and more emphasis will put on regional currencies between two trading countries, and this has been going on already. It's not a full de-dollarization, but it's moving in that direction. And I'm hoping, I know Ethiopia and Africa very well, and Egypt, that this will now lead to the kind of development that Africa needs in infrastructure, in energy development, in manufacturing, which the West has refused repeatedly to give. So I would say today is a bad day for the World Bank and IMF, a very bad day for Secretary of State Blinken, and a bad day for many Western leaders. But there's nothing they can do about it except change their thinking, reflect on the errors of their way, and make changes to support the policies of the BRICS.
How much of the notion of BRICS in this summit do you think, Richard, was based on the fact that the countries felt like they were exhausted or wanted to push back against the U.S. hegemonic moves, as it's been called, but in particular things like sanctions, things like the foreign policy endeavors that the U.S. wants these countries to bend to, that of which they wanted to reject and push back. And of course, this also may involve things like de-dollarization. But how much of a motivating factor did this have for the countries that not only now are members, but also future ones who want to join?
I was accredited to cover the summit, and I've been watching for 3 days straight, and there is not one speech given by any world leader. And remember, there are over 40 world leaders there, who are, most of them not members, and nevertheless, they still came. There was not one speech where colonialism wasn't mentioned, or sanctions, or the change that is required to drift away, to move away, to diverge from the current situation. Tons of African countries all said that it's time for Africa to have leverage and control over its own resources, to get rid of the remnants of colonialism. And of course, we've seen that on the sidelines in Niger with the latest coup, which is, again, of the fourth coup in Western Africa, a rejection of French colonialism, American bases. And I think this is really important that Iran, out of all countries, has applied and been accepted, because the United States has been trying for years to isolate Iran, the United States and Europe, right? So there was the nuclear deal, there was a glimmer of diplomacy. And then now when they tried to do the nuclear deal again to revive it and resuscitate it, and I was covering it, well, it stopped. And so all these sanctions that Trump put on Iran, the fact that he ripped up the deal, they don't really mean anything. Yes, sanctions are evil, and they are siege warfare, and they do hurt. But there are very few countries that are able to outmaneuver such a situation as Iran has done. Iran is now in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and joined within the last year. Iran is now a part of BRICS, right? And so Iran and Saudi Arabia, who made peace together, and then Saudi Arabia with Yemen and Syria, all of these things matter. It's truly a monumental shift, not just in regional politics in West Asia, but in the whole world. I think a lot of countries applied to join BRICS because they are sick of sanctions and they are sick of this behavior. You cannot steal $300 billion from Russia and just walk away. The whole world was watching when the Americans froze Russia's foreign exchange reserves last year, and that was really the final nail in the coffin. How can you blame any country for looking at that and thinking, you know what, I'm not going to use dollars anymore, because what if one day they don't like my policies? Are they going to freeze me out from my treasuries and foreign exchange reserves? What's going to happen to me if I cross the United States? So this is a natural response to the United States behavior, and specifically the freezing of Russia's assets, because they went, this is the Russian central bank. Every country is looking at that and thinking we need a new solution. As the other guest said, even if there wasn't a BRICS currency announced, it's certainly moving in the direction of de-dollarization. And you're going to have more countries within BRICS using their local currencies, just like, for example, Russia is sure. Selling oil to India, and India paying in rupees. This is what's important. They don't need to necessarily make a new currency yet, but using their own currencies is certainly going to help a lot and save them from this kind of behavior that we talked about with sanctions.
Indeed. Lawrence Freeman, I'd like to ask you about Africa as a whole, because I know that you have expertise in that field altogether, and what this expansion really means for Africa. One of the interesting developments that came out of the conference that was held in St. Petersburg in Russia recently, the Africa Summit there, is that 19 African countries, it came out, had applied for BRICS membership because they wanted a completely new economic relation. And within that context, the way the news covered it, it said the unipolar world is collapsing and a multipolar world is being formed with the participation of Africa. Even the Iranian president mentioned how important Africa is. Why is Africa so important for BRICS?
Well, first of all, the joint Ethiopia is the second largest population in Africa after Nigeria, and at about 115 to 120 million people. Egypt is the third largest population in Africa at about 105 to 110 million. So just there, you have almost about 225 million people now a part of this new institution. And of course, you have Egypt in the north. You have Ethiopia, the dominant economic power in East Africa, and South Africa, the dominant power at the southern tip of the continent. This is a very significant development for Africa. And as most strategic thinkers would understand, over the next 25, 30 years, the projections are that Africa will have close to 2.5 billion people. About 1 billion people will be under the age of 30. Therefore, really politics, economics, trade, commerce in this century is going to all focus on the African continent. Which has 54 nations in it. And the idea that this continent now is having this kind of participation with the BRICS is very important for the BRICS, and it's very important for Africa. You now have 3 of the 11 nation members will be from Africa, which, as I say, is the future for all economics and politics in the century that we're living in. And this gives new potential for Africa, because what Africa desperately needs is a manufacturing. It needs energy, and it needs rail transportation. There's a plan for high-speed rail transportation, which I just put up on my website. There's a need for 1,000 gigawatts of power, new power in Africa. The poverty is killing Africa, like the lack of electricity is killing Africa. So this new arrangement, and the BRICS is a different paradigm. It's not based on control by the monetarist political factions in the West and the World Bank and the IMF. The BRICS paradigm is a paradigm of development. And we can lift 500 people out of poverty in Africa the same way it has been done in China. And as I say, this now represents to the world the embryonic, an embryonic new institution that will grow. I don't know if the IMF World Bank is going to end, but they're no longer in control. And countries are looking for development, as the other speaker mentioned. The coup in Niger is part of the same process. The Nigerians are poor, the poorest country in the world. 3% of them have access to electricity. The French are there. The United States is there. And they say our conditions are not getting any better under Western control. Poverty, insecurity. And so this coup is now another wake-up call for the West, and it's part of the same shift we're seeing where the new rules-based order ain't in charge anymore. And that's something the West is going to have to come to terms with.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, but they're not, are they? And Richard, I mean,
not so far.
Yeah, but you know, you mentioned coup. I think I'm sorry, Niger. And Richard, you also mentioned Niger. We're seeing how not only the U.S., which has a large drone base there, which also the French use, they are using military threats in order to come back into the country, specifically France through ECOWAS even. And I think if I'm correct to look at it this way, African countries are watching that. And not only that. Other countries, such as Iran, for example, are watching the way that the U.S. and France, in this case, are using the military card once again to want to basically get to their own interests. Are we looking at the fact that when BRICS is gaining this power that it is now for sure in its possession, that the U.S. will continue down that path? Because I don't think the U.S. is going to digress or remove sanctions or not use military card when it comes to his foreign policy, for example.
Yes, the situation in Niger is it's quite precarious. You know, as the other speaker mentioned, people are, the majority of people in Niger are living in poverty, and what's all the more disgusting is that the uranium being mined there is, of course, to the benefit of France, and you know, one in three light bulbs in France are lit by uranium that comes from Niger. Meanwhile, the majority of people in Niger, 80%, around 80% of people in Niger don't even have electricity. Just a normal electricity grid, never mind nuclear energy. And so, you know, that those coups that we saw in Burkina Faso and in Mali and now in Niger, they're a rejection of multiple things. They're a rejection of this neo-colonialism, where you have French corporations on behalf of the French state coming in and stealing, plundering the uranium and the other resources. And they're also a rejection of the military presence because, you know, you have the American troops with this massive drone base. It's their largest in the world, in Africa, if not the world. And it costs about $100 million to build. I think most Americans don't even know it exists, and yet it is there. And it projects American military power in Africa. The excuse, the pretext that they use for their presence is that they are here to fight jihadists and so on, right? Well, before 2011, before the French and the Americans specifically came and bombed Libya and destroyed the most prosperous country in Africa and assassinated Gaddafi, who is one of the most iconic leaders in the world, and not just the Arab world, but in the entire world. They allowed and created these conditions for groups like Boko Haram, like Al-Qaeda, like ISIS to thrive. This wasn't an issue before 2011, just like it wasn't an issue before they invaded Iraq. Saddam Hussein is a different issue completely, but there was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq. There was no ISIS in Iraq.
Sure.
So by invading, they allowed these conditions to happen and to thrive. And then they used that as an excuse to come put their bases. The truth is that the only ones that actually fought these jihadist groups in Syria, for example, and in Iraq, they're the Hashd al-Sha'bi, the PMU, the Syrian army, Iran, and Russia. And in in Africa, it's actually the Russian Wagner group that's doing the job properly. The Americans and French don't want to deal with the issue. They want to pretend that they're dealing with it.
Viewer comments. BRICS now has population power, oil power, industrial power, mineral power, agricultural power, and increasingly technological power. So last question, Lawrence Freeman. The viewer goes on to say, when it comes to the world economy, nobody's going to care about the G7 or what Brussels or Washington has to say. Is that just a dream, or is that actually something that may become a reality and we will see BRICS countries dictating and pushing back against U.S. diktats and European diktats? Less than a minute, please.
Well, as I said, the BRICS now has the power that you just outlined. And I think it's in an embryonic form. I think it's going to grow and grow. And I think there's going to be more and more resistance to bank behaving under the control of the rules-based order in their financial system. The most important questions for me is, will the BRICS proceed as rapidly as possible on providing low-interest loans for infrastructure development in Africa and in the global south? And is the lack of infrastructure that is just killing the peoples of these countries? Number two, will the West or some element of the West realize that they're losing and they have to regroup and reformulate a policy that actually adjusts to the new reality that we just have observed?
Thank you very much, Lawrence Freeman, Africa affairs expert there from Baltimore. And Richard Mertens, it's a pleasure seeing you after a while, journalist and commentator there from Vienna. Thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the program. Thanks for tuning in. From Miko Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number